Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hey GabFest fans, this is a very special episode of the Political GabFest. We celebrated our 15th anniversary with a fantastic live show on December 9th. It was a night of reminiscing, looking back on past mistakes, and delivering fresh kindnesses. And here's the podcast edition of that wonderful show. So happy listening and happy new year. We'll be back with a regular show next week. Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political GabFest for December 9th, 2020, the 15th anniversary edition. We are live on Facebook and YouTube. We wish we were live in a theater somewhere, but we're in our living rooms. I'm David Plotz of CityCast. I'm at home in my living room in Washington, D.C. I am joined by my beloved co-hosts of all these years from New York City, John Dickerson of CBS's 60 Minutes. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Orleans, yet she's found a new place to go, not a New Haven, a New Orleans, Emily Bazelon of Yale University Law School and the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello, John and David.
Did you guys get your Trump pardon in the mail today? I got mine. It was great.
What crime would you be guilty of that you would need pardoning for?
I think, as we'll discover in the course of the show, it's probably sanctimony and stupidity. What about you?
Luckily, those are not in the criminal statute.
Some petty larceny, you know, just to spice up the day.
Emily?
Let's see.
You don't have to. It's okay.
No. You're greed, on the record, avarice, counselor. Impatience, vanity, irritation.
Do you know charity, chastity, prudence, and hope? That my mother had this, I'm sure I've said this on the show before, my mother had this friend who was the youngest of three girls. The first girl was named Faith, the second one was named Hope, and the third one was named Brenda. Anyway.
That's the eighth deadly sin.
So we are at our quinceañera. The 15th anniversary is the crystal anniversary, which is appropriate because on the GabFest, we try to be clear and sharp like crystal, and we break crystal when we occasionally hurl it at each other, as even happy families do. But tonight we're here to celebrate, hopefully not too self-indulgently, the longest and most satisfying venture, at least of my professional career. Week after week after week, the three of us show up in studios, on stage, on Zoom, to have a conversation among dear friends. And we began podcasting the year podcasting was coined, apparently. We were brought together by our former colleague and godfather of Slate podcasting, Andy Bowers. We are still joyfully here, and I'm so glad to be here with you guys for a night of nostalgia, for a nostalgia trip.
We're happy to be with you, too.
And we look forward to someday seeing you actually in person, and our audience actually in person.
Tonight, it's going to be sort of a normal structure. We're going to reminisce about some of our favorite GabFest moments, some issues that have obsessed and fascinated us, and about what we learned from each other. Then we will do some cocktail chatter. Plus, we're going to take your questions live. So wherever you're watching this, you can put your questions directly in the chat, Facebook, YouTube, and we will pick them up. So we're also doing something special for this 15th anniversary special show, which is that we have a partner, the Winemaker Series, and we're going to be tasting three carefully selected wines from Round Pond Estate, one for each segment of the show tonight. And we are really happy that hundreds of you are going to be able to taste those wines from home along with us.
Can we, just before we get into the series, can we just for a moment paint the picture of what the first room was in which we did the show?
Briefly.
So for those of you at home, so imagine you have a TV tray. That's the size of the desk on which we had these three microphones planted. And they were in a conference room, which I've said it before, I'll say it again, was the saddest chair museum in America. It had like 30 different chairs, and all of them in their last exhausted breath before they totally collapsed. And that's where we did the show for years.
So we're going to talk about what's happened over 15 years, some of which what happened on the show and some of which just happened in the world. So what has changed? We are a political show. John, what has changed in politics? What are the fundamental things that have changed in politics from the time we started this back in 2005?
What's changed in politics? We've learned that so much was part of an agreement. And that agreement required everybody to kind of agree to it. And it turns out the power of that agreement can be challenged across so many different areas. And that it doesn't just take one president who chooses to not heed to that agreement, but that you can have an entire party, which once was the standard keeper of a lot of those agreements, not think that they mean so much anymore. And that, you know, all the rules that I covered when I first came to Washington in 1995, so many of them are up for grabs. We're about to head into an amazing period of redefinition, or maybe not. But so I guess the extent to which so much was an agreement and how that has been revealed.
This is interesting because, Emily, I'm going to ask you sort of the legal end of that. But before I ask you that, can I actually, because John, you approached it from the vector of the presidency. I'll approach it from the vector of sort of the citizenry, which is that I feel like Jonathan Rauch had this wonderful piece. He's an Atlantic writer, maybe 5 years ago, where he pointed out a really significant number of Americans didn't believe in politics anymore, that they fundamentally didn't trust the process that was politics, the idea of compromise, the idea that you negotiated in partnership with a loyal opposition and people gave some and got some, because there was so, what had happened was that there was so much cynicism about the system because people were doing, like, their lives weren't great, but also people had just become divided from each other, that you so lived in a world of people like you, that people who were not like you had become quite threatening and alien and in some cases, you know, not equal to you, not legitimate. I think when you have citizens, when you have when Rauch wrote the piece, I think he was saying it was like 30% of Americans. I think today you'd probably poll it and you'd find a much higher percentage of people who basically don't believe in the political compact. And when you have a huge, and most of those people are on the right, not all of them, but most of them are on the right. And when you have that much distrust in a political system, I just don't see how it can operate in the long term. Emily, do you want to take it from a legal perspective? Like, what do you think the biggest shift is there?
I'm not sure the biggest shifts are legal, actually. In some ways, I don't think, you know, we've had huge things happen. I mean, we had the legalization of same-sex marriage, enormous change for civil rights and changes in people's lives that are very real. When you think, though, about the kinds of political divide you're describing, though, I don't actually think it's the laws that have changed. I mean, this has become a cliche to trot out at this point about the Trump presidency, but it's really this set of norms when you talk about agreement and social compact. I wonder, though, so when we started the show in 2005, George W. Bush was president, correct? That is a true fact.
Correct.
Yes. Are you trying to establish
ladies and gentlemen,
a fact pattern here?
Leading political analyst of
it's
the
just
age.
Amazing the things I get wrong.
Emily Bazelon.
So when you think about going back to George W. Bush's presidency, I do wonder how much the fact that these sort of norms of agreement of like the rules of the road still appearing to operate was masking some actually very deep divisions. I mean, when you think about, you know, the Iraq War, the abuses, the torture that took place at that time, the deep divisions over whether to do anything about inequality and poverty, which were beginning to be bigger problems then. Then I start to wonder if there's actually more of a continuum, and it was just that people observed niceties more on each side, and so we didn't see it. I'm not sure I myself agree with that thesis, but let's put it out there for a moment. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, can't you have both? I mean, in other words, you can have one set of roiling problems that are bigger than we knew, and then you can have the death of agreement and norms. And they're connected, but they don't... I think they can both exist. I think the power to blow through a lot of those norms, the propulsive force behind it, is the connection that those who felt upset with the political system, the connection they felt to President Trump and still feel to him, surely must be in part inflamed, although then we can get into a conversation about why there's the adhesion to President Trump that there is, but is inflamed by some of those issues that you are arguing perhaps were, you know, thundering beneath the surface, but that weren't as much of our public dialogue, although they were kind of part of our public dialogue. But
I mean, sometimes I think it's a difference in degree. And right now it feels like a difference in kind. I mean, I don't think the outgoing Bush administration did not behave in this fashion. It was different, right? Because it wasn't the end of a one-term presidency when President Obama became president. This I feel certain of, and you're nodding affirmatively. But so in that sense, it's different. But it's still, I just can't imagine those politicians, those elected officials, those appointed officials behaving in this way. And so this moment does feel like a different in kind, and yet there are ways in which I think the Republican Party was stoking the division. It just didn't quite understand how big the embers were that then have burst into flame.
Yeah. I mean, this goes back to the David Plotz's favorite thesis, which is that the most important election of our lifetimes was in 1992, and George H.W. Bush should have won, and that would have potentially prevented the Republican Party from going in this disastrous direction. But we can save that for another year. I want to talk about something that's near and dear to me, which is something that we've changed our thinking on because of each other. And let me go first on this because I have something queued up. I've been listening back to some of our favorite bits. Jocelyn pulled some of them. And I want to play this incredible moment back from 2014. I actually think this is the greatest moment in GabFest history. And it's I'm embarrassed at myself and incredibly impressed at Emily. And I was completely wrong. She was absolutely right. And I learned a lot, and it's stuck with me. So it dates back to 2014. And the backstory is that a woman named Deborah Harrell had been arrested for endangering the life of her daughter. She worked at McDonald's. Her daughter had played on a laptop at McDonald's while her mom worked. Then the laptop was stolen, and the daughter asked if she could play on a playground instead. So the mom gave her daughter a cell phone and let her play on the playground. And while this child was playing alone, another parent saw the daughter and called the cops. So we discussed this. We started off by agreeing we all felt rage at the situation, and we talked a bit, but we pick up this clip right now as I was commenting that the playground wasn't the worst option for a kid to be there for. And the clip is about 5 minutes long, so bear with it, because I think it really, you know, Emily, congratulations.
It doesn't seem like the worst place to leave somebody, better than leaving them indoors without...
Yeah.
Or not around other people.
Have we looked at the statute in South Carolina about whether it would have been endangerment to leave her home alone all day?
Well, the statute in South Carolina, like the statute everywhere, is very vague. It's about, you know, being reasonable, providing reasonable supervision under the circumstances, which is always what these laws say. So, like, if you leave, you know, I have definitely left my 11-year-old home for some amount of time. And what the jokes about, well, how long could that last for before you get in trouble? There's no answer to that question because it's all very discretionary from the point of view of the state.
We don't really need to get to this because the point has been made, but one reason why everyone's so outraged is, oh, what if the child had been abducted? And of course, we just have to point out, there are so few stranger abductions in this country, as you might as well say none. There are not none, but there are just so few. Someone calculated that if you leave a child alone in a car, the child would have to wait there for 750,000 years before the child would be abducted by a stranger.
So this is where
It's so much more dangerous to drive around with your kid in the car just based on the number of car accidents than it is to leave a child alone in the park.
Doesn't this go back to Emily's original point about race and class, which is that it's not the thing itself for which the mother was arrested, but it was tip of the iceberg. So if the kid's being left alone in a park all day, then untold horrible other things are a part of her life too. That sign of you don't have discrete negligence. That it's.
Can we also say what person called the police on this kid?
Oh, like, no. This is on. Oh good. This is where we're gonna have a fight. This is
so
awesome.
My feeling
this
about
is awesome.
That person, whoever he or she is, was that you could ask with concern what's going on, and then maybe you try and help. How is calling the police helping
instead of
maybe seeing if there's some way
Emily,
you could help supervise
this is
or
where
there's some
smug,
other private resolution
this is where your smug
you
self-righteousness ends. Because I wanted to pose this question to you guys. You were at a, let's say you go to a playground. You go there in the morning with your child. You go there. You hang out. You see a kid playing alone. You go back at lunchtime. You left something at the park. You go back, check. Oh, the kid is still there playing alone. There's not really – doesn't seem to be attached to any adults. You go back in the evening. The kid is still there playing alone. It is – would be bizarre in this world not to ask yourself questions about this child.
Yeah. Well,
I
bizarre
didn't say
not to
ask
talk
questions,
to the child.
David.
And bizarre
I didn't say
when
that
the child
either.
Tells you her mom – is at work or is vague about it, not to think like maybe I have a responsibility to do something.
Well, there's a middle ground.
Call the police, David. That's the part that I'm arguing with. I am with you up until that.
You
try to talk to the parent to see what's happening.
You assume that the police are, I assume in this society, maybe I'm wrong, the police are kind of the good guys. They're going to help sort it out, make sure the kids are okay.
Why do you assume that? I tell my children never to speak to the police if they can possibly avoid it. The police cause trouble.
Oh my God. That is the most interesting thing I've ever learned about you.
No, I'm completely serious about that. The police are – you treat the police with the utmost care and you try to keep them as far away from your life as you possibly can.
That's so interesting, Emily. That is so – interesting.
That's how I feel about the police.
You lied to the police when the police confronted you.
We have to have a show on that entire subject.
I do not think in a situation where you are worried about an unsupervised kid that calling the police is any kind of wise move unless you think there is evidence of criminality
and
danger.
My gosh.
If you think a kid is being abused,
that
you might call the Department of Children's Services. I would never call the police
the kind
on a kid
of
in this
paranoia,
situation.
Anti,
I would try to work it out.
Anti-authority paranoia. Which
paranoia,
You're vindicated in this case, but the wrong that was done here was done by the cops. It wasn't done by the parent who called the cops.
I totally disagree. I think this is exactly a situation of how we don't have enough just private trying to talk to people and work problems out in this society. And everybody goes straight to the red alert alarm system and to government authority instead of trying to just ask a simple question and talk to someone and find out what's going on.
But the kid says – sorry, John. The kid says my mom is at work.
And why did you call me smug 5 minutes ago, by the way?
The kid says the mom's at work because it's just a convenient adjective that I keep – it's like lodged in a corner of my brain.
It's
whenever Emily
is saying
something, I disagree. I just say smug. It doesn't have anything to do with the content of what you said.
Okay, good.
You've broken the circuit.
But here's the thing.
Are we back?
We're back.
Dear listeners. The scorching heat of Emily's take destroyed the internet for 10 minutes. It was good because I crawled into a hole and lashed myself.
So the reason that I felt so sure that calling the police was a really poor choice for dealing with that kind of incident was all the reporting I've done in cities where things go wrong when people call the police. So I can remember whose face I was thinking about when I said all of that. And the reporting I've done since then has only borne that out. And of course, not in that clip, but elsewhere in that show, we talked about race and the fact that when white people call the police on black people, that obviously tends to be particularly egregious and harmful or has a higher risk of turning out that way. And that is a lesson we have learned over and over again in the years since.
I have no idea what I was saying. I think I was speaking in voice for you about some earlier point you'd made about race and class. Because when I heard what I said, I thought, huh? Anyway, so whatever point you made earlier was good enough that I was repeating it.
I'm deeply embarrassed by what I said and how condescending and obnoxious I was.
Although that condescension and obnoxiousness, I guess, is part of the show. But man, you were right, Emily. I'm sorry. You were absolutely right, and I was wrong. And I'm glad I listen to you sometimes. So,
so I'm going to change the subject to something that I was wrong about, or that I learned from you, which is that early in the reporting on campus sexual assault, I was much more taken with getting the stories of victims, especially women, and not thinking very much about the rights of people who are accused, and particularly making sure that you've done everything you can as a reporter to find out the other side of the story, even if you don't think it's right, that you've gone to the person who's accused of assault and make sure that they have a chance to respond. And David, you impressed that on me, both on the show and also as the editor of Slate, and I feel deeply grateful to you for that because I think it saved me from mistakes I might have made. And obviously the, you know, story that unraveled at UVA, whatever that was later in the middle of all of that, was the biggest example. I like to think I wouldn't have been that reporter without you, but you definitely helped make sure I was not that reporter. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
And this is why these guys are so great to be with and think with out loud, and why it's always been so great to have an audience that mostly, I'd say super, super, super high percentage of our audience, and certainly 100% of our devoted audience allows, you know, the fumbling, occasionally, pretty occasionally, overheated debate to exist without, you know, allows room for all of that. And that's why it's so great to have these debates with you two.
I want to mention two qualities that I admire in each of you. Favorite quality in each of you. My favorite quality in you, John, is that as a gabfester, not as a human being, but that you're very soulful. You're sneaky soulful. You're like a super soulful person. And I mean, you're a very weird person, which doesn't come across, I think, as much on the Gabfest, but like in your life, you're like a really distinctive sort of your distinctive self. But you have a kind of like a heart and soulfulness that is it's beautiful. It's like really beautiful. And sometimes it's not always out on the Gabfest because you're also being like the keen analyst that you are and talker that you are. But that soulfulness is wonderful. And Emily, for you as a Gabfester, not as you in your human qualities are magnificent in all sorts of other ways, but I have never met someone who is so clear about things. Like anything you explain and it stays explained. It, like, you start a sentence, you finish the sentence. If I start a sentence, it might or might not finish. I might go somewhere else with it. And you, like, people used to say that about Hillary Clinton, like that every paragraph made sense when she spoke. And you have that quality. It's like you, when you understand something, and first of all, you understand almost everything, but when you understand it, you explain it so well. And that is rare, very rare quality to have.
So I feel like John has taught me that you're supposed to be good at taking compliments and like figure out how to bask in them. And I just still have trouble, but thank you. I deeply appreciate that. So my favorite thing about John on the show is the way he doesn't let us, in our knee-jerk way, discount the counter-arguments for whatever point is being made, especially if it's a politically or ideologically divisive point. He forces me to think about why my, you know, liberal preconceptions might be totally wrong and really think it through and, like, holds us to that. And I think it's because, John, you have this deeper quality of combining your analytical rigor with this really enormous heart that tends to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, but without being a chump. You know, like in the wake of Obama's book, where we're all sort of imagining an Obama that had like 15% less chumpiness, like, you know, you're sort of that person.
That, I can't handle this.
Okay.
So I'm gonna pay it back to both of you, even though I know you have one more for David. But so Emily, back to you. Watching you report, and particularly on the things you report about and the way you do, you know, I go around a lot of places. I spend a lot of time on the road. I, you know, interview a lot of people. But You're watching you report is a marvel. And having, you know, over the years talked to you about the things you're reporting and listened to you wrestle with these things and the number of calls you make and the places you go and the people you care about, and telling the story is just, it's a really, that's what I was trying to say when we were on Colbert is, you know, in my other life, I think about the way you report and it makes my work, I hope, better, or at least it tells me how I'm not doing it as well. And David, there is a kind of question I ask now, and I think the kids at the dinner table know this is when to stop listening to me, but it's something I hold like central to my career after 2005, when I came to Slate and when we started this, which is thinking about questions and questioning things in just like this whole other way than I ever did before in the previous 15 years of journalism before I came to Slate. Turning questions around in that way, you know, in sort of like a Rubik's Cube is, which I do, you know, I do a lot now, totally all comes from you. I mean, there's other people too, but I associate it most.
Stop while you're ahead.
Yeah.
Leave it with me.
I'm going to add about David that David makes the show by being willing to say things that most people are afraid to express out loud because they might be totally wrong or they might really offend someone. And without the crazy uncle buying Bitcoin, which I think was your phrase when we were on Colbert, like the show loses all of its provocative edge. And it's not easy. Like, you have taken a lot of criticism over the years for things that you've said, but without that willingness to get out on a limb and sometimes actually saw it off, the show is just so much less interesting and urgent and sticking in with people during the week because you make us, again, it's like about making sure the arguments are solid, but you're just willing to take chances that we only tentatively venture after you, and it's essential.
All right, well, let's move on. That was humbling.
That was humbling and very beautiful, and we are deeply grateful.
Now I don't need to go to my own funeral or to your funerals. So let's go to cocktail chatter. So each of us had a chatter we were going to share on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert as part of our celebration. But that discussion got so lively with Colbert around corruption and pardons that we didn't get a chance to share it there. So let us share those lost chatters now. John, what's your chatter?
So my chatter was when I was looking up pardons and the history of pardons and going back and looking at the delicate, super delicate dance between Nixon and Ford. And Al Haig goes over to, who's chief of staff for Nixon, goes over to see Ford, and he's got a list of six options for Nixon about what he might do, including pardoning himself. But number six was that that Ford, would he be, were he to become president, would then pardon Nixon. And Ford said, you know, said, Al, I'm an interested party. I can't talk to you about this. So this is not my chatter. But Ford, when no one was watching, told Al Haig to go away. It's just a reminder that occasionally people, when you could do something easier, they do actually the right thing. Anyway, the chatter is about on the day that Ford pardoned Nixon, about which people feel a lot more anger towards him, that same day, Evel Knievel tried to jump the Snake River.
Oh.
So we think of life now as being full of like crazy crashing coincidences. But Evel Knievel tried to jump the Snake River 1,600 feet across, 500 down. And I guess I remember that, but I've forgotten what a total cock-up it was. I mean, he basically, the rocket ship he was in, first of all, the whole week leading up, there were basically different newscasts about how, the different kinds of ways he could die. And he sat and watched these in preparation for his launch. He launched, and like seconds afterwards, the parachute deployed. The rocket, which was on its ascent, went down into the canyon. He was fine. I think he broke his nose. Although, I think in his life, he got 433 fractures. Anyway, that happened on the very same day Ford pardoned Nixon. And there were, apparently, there were, you know, a variety of different headlines. And in one, I don't know if it was in the same town, but let's just imagine it was for the purposes of this chatter, that one newspaper's headline was Ford pardons Nixon, and another one had a headline that read, Evel Knievel fails to die.
So, I remember watching that. I wonder if that's a legit memory or if that's an implanted memory. I do remember watching him try to do that.
By the way,
but I would have been five, maybe.
Hmm.
there was a story that his first, he was, once when he started his daredevil career, for those who weren't alive for all of this, basically Evel Knievel used to shoot himself forward at ramps. Some people said he was jumping a motorcycle, but essentially he wiped out so much, it was more like he was just careening propelling into himself. Ramps and propelling himself into ramps. Anyways, when he was in construction, he tried to do a wheelie with a some piece of construction equipment, knocked out electricity for the whole town of Butte, Montana. So that's how his career started.
Emily, what is your chatter?
My chatter is about a coral reef in Mexico, which got hit by Hurricane Delta in October and is being saved and rebuilt because it is the first natural structure in the world to have an insurance policy. So this is a story about environmental renewal that has like a total legal technical side, which makes it perfect for me. I read about it in the New York Times, the story by Katrine Einhorn and Christopher Flavel. And basically, this state in Mexico called Quintana Roo, which has Tulum and Cancun in it, was really worried about its coral reefs. And so it contracted with an insurance company to buy a policy that would kick in and give money back to the state if the wind speed of a hurricane exceeded 100 knots. So Hurricane Delta did exceed 100 knots. The state of Quintana Roo got $850,000 and used that money to pay for a team of volunteer divers to go down, pick up the broken pieces of the coral reef that had fallen off, and paste them back on with some special paste that they created. This is a way of rebuilding coral reefs. I guess it's like if you lose a tooth or even if you lose like a finger, to be really gross, if you put it back in quickly, it can presumably regrow and regenerate. This idea of having funds that comes from insurance policies could be used for salt marshes and other kinds of natural structures that humans also need. And one of the reasons why the coral reef was important to the state is that it actually protects the land from surging coastal waves. And so it's not just like a beautiful structure that's important to the ecosystem of the ocean, though it is all those things and provides for lots of species diversity, but it's also integral to the structure of this part of Mexico. So I, in my, law hat self, love the idea of an insurance policy for this coral reef. And it seems like it could be a model that other countries and states could follow.
Yeah, not to be a downer, but isn't the real problem with coral reefs is just temperature hikes, which you can't really insure against?
Yeah, you can't. Someone brought that up in the piece. You can't insure against everything, but hurricanes are something that actually you can address, and they do sudden damage. But you are being a downer.
All right, my chatter is an upper. So there's a great story in the Washington Post about how plastic surgery is having a boom year because of this perfect confluence of events. There's people in the plastic surgery getting class are on Zoom calls, and a lot of them are unhappy with how they look. And so there's a lot of people getting Botox and little bits of face work because they don't like that. And then there's also this thing where since people don't actually have to be in the office or don't have to be anywhere, and in fact, or can't be anywhere for weeks at a time, you could get some serious work done and not worry about someone catching you mid-recovery. So, there's no event to go on, no event you're going to have to go to, no wedding you're going to have to show up at. So you can take a few weeks, recover, and then show up with your new face or your new butt or whatever it is you're going to show up with. And so as a result, there's this enormous boom in plastic surgery, which I think is very, very funny.
But wouldn't you want to time it right? Like if you were going to do Botox and you got your Botox like 3 months ago, you're still not seeing anyone. I feel like you would want to gain.
No, but the Botox is for Zoom.
Oh, it's for Zoom.
The Botox is for Zoom. Like the boob jobs, the facelifts, the ass stuff.
Fix that.
You could also just hide self-view on Zoom. That is a cheaper alternative that I recommend.
So we're going to take some of your questions. You can put them in Facebook and YouTube. We've got a bunch already. We're going to start with a question that came in from Benjamin Zalisco. How much do the three of you talk when you're not podcasting? How does having so much of your relationship during a filtered, self-conscious podcast affect the nature of your relationships? That's a pretty direct question. I like to get it. We're going to be very self-indulgent this show, so let's talk about it. I'll go first about this. Emily, you and I talk frequently. John, you and I talk less. And
although we have a lovely walk recently.
That's true. And whenever we have a chance to be together, because none of us live in the same city. In the same city, we always take the time to be with each other and spend time together. And that, to me, has been genuinely, like, really important. It really matters. And you both came to my 50th birthday party, which was, like, the last event before lockdown. And it remains kind of etched in my memory because, I mean, it was my birthday party, so I guess it would be. But it was just a wonderful occasion to be together. I mean, I think, 90% of our conversation is on the show, I suppose. But it allows the 10% that isn't to also be warm and rich and deep for me. So I...
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
I'm so thankful to have that part outside the show, even though most of it's inside the show.
We also all talk to each other when we need to, right? Like, we're... If you knock, the person is there.
Yeah, right. Which is like that 10% you're talking about, David. It has a... Knowing that's there is very powerful, too.
Okay, let's do an audio question. Why don't we do a question from Alan Laird?
Hello, this is Alan Laird. I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the USA. And my question is for John, but it would be fun to hear from Emily and David. If you could interview anyone, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
So I'd want to talk to Jesus. And then pretty much just listen.
Excellent choice. The dead or alive, Emily? Threw me. I had a good, like, alive question, and now I don't know what to say because it's so prosaic, and if you include dead people.
All right. What is it? Go ahead.
Well, this is not including all the dead people. This is alive people. And I guess also I didn't try to think outside the United States. But I would like to have a real honest interview with Bill Barr, our attorney general. Like a real interview where I got to find out what he was thinking.
You mean where you give him sodium pentothal or where it was off the record? Or you mean just with
enough
time?
Where he just trusts me and it's off the record. And I get to hear like what he was really thinking and doing and like about the decisions he made.
Jesus or Bill Barr?
Well, I know. I told you it was
that's
really tough.
That's hard. Huh. I don't know. Yeah. I got to think on that one. I mean, I'll give my prosaic answer too, which is prosaic because I always give this answer, which is Ulysses S. Grant, because he's my favorite American and I just loved reading him. And so I think I would love hearing him talk. And he was such a self-aware, ironic, funny person that I bet he would have been a great, great conversationalist. I'm going to continue to get questions which are about us. So from Ryan Moore, how did you three meet? How are we introduced? Because I remember distinctly meeting each of you.
I remember that
and separately.
Too.
Well, John and I started at Slate in the same month. Remember?
Yeah.
So Emily and I met at the Slate retreat in Newsweek offices in New York at some little, it feels like it was some little bar they had set up for us or something. Anyway, in the room we were in was a conference room in which it felt like 3 feet, maybe it was four. There was a column that was the size of a VW bug. It was basically a room full of columns. And then there were little places where we would sit at tables and try to have talks. But in the talks, you had to go like this because you are always slaloming around the columns. So I remember that we were both there at the same time, although I was writing my book. So I wasn't, that was like a, I was there, but I wasn't really there. And then David, you and I met.
Yeah, it was before you like officially started, right?
Right. And David, I think we, did we, whether or not we may have met beforehand, the real meeting was in the Bob Inglis, Ernest Fritz Hollings race in 1998 in various parts of South Carolina, right?
Yeah, we covered that race. It was great. That was really important to me in all kinds of ways. Meeting you, some great stories I did came out of that. That was awesome. And Emily, you and I met. We had a mutual friend.
You don't remember this. You only remember this because I told you about this.
Oh, okay. Why don't you tell the story?
Well, Jacob hired me, and then I moved to Washington, where you were the deputy editor of Slate and like the whatever of the Washington office, main poobah. And I came in, and we like went out and had coffee. It was cold. You were wearing like a blue knit cap, and you just seemed so skeptical of me. I just remember being really sure that Jacob had hired me, and you were just like, okay, whatever. Do you remember that office? Like, it didn't have any framed anything on the wall. There was like a Israeli poster of like a carrot that was also sort of a penis. And like, do you remember that? Yeah.
Yeah, that was Avi Zendelman, our intern whose dad was a public health, a sex public health doctor, had given us that it was some Israeli STD health poster. I don't know why it was there.
But yeah, I walked into that office, and at that point, there happened to be no women working out of that DC office except for the poor intern who was a little beleaguered, and it lacked a woman's touch, shall we say.
Was that the office with the chair museum?
No. Yes. Yeah, it was. M Street.
Oh, my God. Okay. That office was...
Yeah.
God, it was sad.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Let's do just a couple more as we bring this home. So how about an audio question from Daniel Fabiano?
Hi, this is Daniel Fabiano from Toronto. My question is, as listeners, we know that David and Emily and John enjoy a good metaphor, especially John. What metaphor describes how each of you prepares for an episode of the Gabfest?
I sometimes feel like a squirrel eating nuts, yes, and like chewing on them and trying to stuff them into my cheeks so that maybe I'll remember them.
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good one, Emily. I like that.
That's good. I like that. Yeah.
All right. One more audio question from Cynthia Lerner.
Hi, this is Cynthia Lerner from Northbrook, Illinois. My question is, have you ever cried during the Gabfest? And if yes, why? Tears of joy? Sadness, relief, any kind. Thank you.
I think
I'm sure I have more. I think I have more than.
Do you remember doing it? I don't.
I do. I remember.
I think you
doing
have it. I remember you doing it, Emily. Sure. Like in the I remember you.
Oh, right.
Sort of just outside the show. I don't think it was on the show because I was such an asshole.
Oh, right. We had the fight once.
So, you know, when I...
I don't know if I actually...
Oh, sorry, Emily.
Yeah, you go, please.
I remember... Well, it was once, I think, about my dad, once about Anne, once about you guys, and I think once about my kids, who actually are basically almost a little bit older than the Gabfest, and they actually happen to be standing behind me. So, that's one of them.
Look!
Oh.
Special treat. We've gotten the whole Dickerson family tonight.
The whole Dickerson clan.
That is so great. Hi,
they
Bryce and Nan.
We're just little babies when we started, and now they're full human adults.
Adults.
So anyway, thanks, guys.
We all started this when we had young children. All of our children have now grown up. They are, I guess, I have the youngest. I have a 12-year-old, and then Emily, you and I have 20-year-olds, or maybe. Your eldest is 21.
20.
So, but they've all grown. They've been basically Gabfest children. How has that affected us? Have they changed our political views?
My children at this point often know more about politics than I do. Find it somewhat dismaying that anyone would listen to their mother talk about politics or really pretty much anything. But they have definitely challenged my views because, especially on questions of economic policy. Zoning is a hot topic in my house. They have really taught me a huge amount.
seeing questions through their eyes, seeing and explaining things when you suddenly, or when you start seeing yourself talking through the way they would see you, or, and just like that whole set of mirrors affects me a lot. And then also debates and discussions with them as they've gotten older, you know, you really, you, like, you can't wing it the way you can on the show. You know, you have to, it's a lot, it has to be a lot more buttoned up because they're not such accommodating interlocutors the way you guys are. And I think
also they have an impatience, right? Often, like the impatience of youth and a willingness to challenge things that we've just become inured to, which is like really necessary and adds urgency.
It also makes me think about the stakes, like amazingly, to what the world is going to be like that they will be left, which sometimes can be quite overwhelming when you're doing certain kinds of reporting. I mean, it doesn't happen so much when I think about what we talk about, but that certainly affects the way I look at the world now.
All right, that is a wrap for our 15th anniversary celebration. I'm slightly buzzed and very teary. The Live Gab Fest was produced by Faith Smith, Jocelyn Frank, and Bridget Dunlap, with help from Britt Pooley. Our managing producer is June Thomas. Gabe Roth is editorial director of Slate Audio, and Alicia Montgomery is executive producer of podcasts for Slate. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. Listeners, we asked you to give us incredible politically themed cocktails in honor of our 15th anniversary, and you delivered. We are excited to share some of our favorites at slate.com/cocktail. If you are not a Slate Plus member, you cannot see that website. But so all the more reason to join Slate Plus. So, Emily, tell us a little bit about your cocktail. You don't need to do the whole thing, but just give us a briefing.
So I was having trouble coming up with this, and then I remembered this wonderful, exquisite moment from the summer before last summer, when such things were still possible, when I went on this group camping trip in Maine. It was a car camping trip, but it was in this lovely state park, and I was with two of my college housemates, who I adore, and they were both more organized than me, naturally, and one of them brought along all the makings for this delicious elderberry rum cocktail. I don't think I'd ever had elderberry rum. It had sage in it and other special lovely ingredients. And what I mostly remember about this, well, so it was totally delicious and refreshing. And we were drinking it as the sun was going down, you know, over the pine trees in Maine. But also, Chani, my housemate who made this drink, had brought these glass jars to drink it in. And I had only brought like one, you know, plastic mug. And so I was also impressed that she had exactly the right thing to be drinking in it. I actually love drinking in things like jam jars. I like that as an extra perk. So I just raise a glass to the idea of a cocktail that you could drink with your friends on a camping trip and everyone would be close together and enjoying each other's company and not worried. And I dearly, dearly hope that such things are possible this coming summer. But if not, I look forward to returning to that spot in Maine as soon as we possibly can.
All right. That's Emily's summer freedom cocktail. John, Yes. What is your cocktail?
My cocktail is, well, first it has to be, there's a small preamble, which is there is nothing more boring than a person who sends back a martini. And there is nothing more boring than sending back a martini.
You mean
those are two distinct
like it,
categories?
Sending it back like it's deficient
because you don't like it, right? Because it's been poorly made. It's been poorly made. So this is the height of boredom. If you do this, you are a boorish and boobish person. If you do this, having said that, there is nothing worse than a poorly made martini, and there is this thing in American life where when you order a martini, which is, as everybody knows, is gin, the people who sometimes make it seek to assert their personality by adding stuff to it. Because apparently gin by itself... So the first problem is vermouth. They add too much vermouth. Some people would say they add vermouth at all, but that's you,
there are boundaries. Isn't that a martini, gin and vermouth? If you don't want the vermouth, isn't it a different drink?
It's just straight gin, but that's fine. That's gin martini. But then the other thing they add is olive juice, olive bits. They think somehow when you said you wanted a martini that you want a dirty martini. And over the course of the time they've been in the martini making business, they have added more stuff. So there's like an old shoe, a tire, all of which is in the hopes of making a dirty martini. So my drink is called the Restraint, which means put cold gin, get it as cold as you possibly can in a glass that you've also tried to get as cold as you possibly can. If you're going to add vermouth, add a little, a very restrained portion of vermouth, and then refrain and restrain yourself from adding anything else. Don't add olive juice. Don't add more than one olive. Don't add olive bits. Don't add, just restrain yourself from adding all that other claptrap to the martini.
The restraint. John's prose here is magnificent also. My cocktail, which was made, I proposed pre-election.
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.